Welcome to the Mommy Matters podcast, where Mommy Matters is a double entendre that states and declares that mommies matter, where we have conversations surrounding mommy matters from conception to pregnancy to postpartum, mother and father wounds, dating, mindfulness and self-care, spirituality, parenting, discipline, legislation, money, and so much more. It is my hope and my prayer that the information that you gather here serves as a blueprint for generational and individual ascension. Enjoy. All right. Welcome to the Mommy Matters podcast. It is lovely to be back. Of course, I am your host, Cecile Edwards. And on Mommy Matters, as you know, we talk about all things that matters for moms. And I have been embroiled in the conversation around birth equity and caregivers and maternal health in my state in New Jersey. And we're going to have a conversation with a researcher around these issues today in our topic around a good birth, a safe birth, the role of maternal health providers in constructing birth safety in the United States. So talking about birth safety, what it looks like, what providers' roles are, and what we can also look for as, you know, if we're birthing people or people in families of people who are giving birth. So I am excited to have Turquoise Brewington here today to talk to us about this topic. And that topic is literally the title of her thesis. You can probably Google it and find it because I've done that before with thesis. I just Googled it and found it. And just have this very in-depth conversation about this very important and powerful topic. And one that's important for so many reasons that we'll get into. So Turquoise, introduce yourself. We want to know more about you.
Yes. Thank you so much, Cecile, for having me on the podcast. Hi, everyone. My name is Turquoise Brewington. I'm a recent graduate from Princeton, where I studied public health policy and minored in African American studies and Spanish. And my research is focused on improving maternal health outcomes and combating racial disparities, particularly through perinatal workforce policy initiatives. So thank you again, and I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. I love that, you know, I've always felt, and when I became more savvy, I've always said that, you know, voting is one very minor and small piece, actually, of effective change. It really is. And if I'm being very bold, I would say that it is a bottom of the barrel, actually. Because if you really want to affect change, then you really understand policy, you really talk to your policymakers in your communities, in your state, and you really become involved in the issues by seeing how it impacts you and it impacts people around you. So exactly. Most of us, if not all of us, know a nurse, you know. If we don't know a doctor, we know a nurse. I'm sorry, but I feel like there's nurses.
It's true. It's true.
And some of those nurses may be midwives, right?
Exactly.
One of the first things that I want you to help me or help us to understand and define, because this was very something that when I was able to define it, or someone was able to define it for me, it really made a difference in how I thought about things. It's defined maternal mortality.
Yes.
What is maternal mortality?
Yes. So in my research and just in general, I kind of use the CDC's definition of maternal mortality. And so that is, quote, the death of a woman during pregnancy, at delivery, or soon after delivery. But I want to expand that definition because not all people who give birth identify as women. So I would say birthing people. But that's how I have been using the definition in my research and other work on maternal health.
Absolutely. So that, when we hear maternal mortality, we tend to think of just, you know, the woman dying in birth. But it can be while pregnant, and it can be up to, I believe, a year
exactly
after delivery.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an important distinction to make. And I think it's something that it's important to define and for people to know.
Mm-hmm.
And your research came about because there was only a little bit of research on the relationship between identity and defining birth safety. So what does even birth safety mean?
Mm-hmm.
And your research focuses specifically on midwives and OBGYNs,
yes,
to understand if policy targeting maternal health in the workforce is sufficient to address the maternal health crisis in the United States and combat racial disparities.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, specifically assessing the risk and defining the conditions of a safe birth. So mm-hmm. I think this is interesting because OBGYNs and midwives have a slightly different, first of all, framework.
Exactly.
And as well as, of course, that's going to lead into how they define safety in birth, what that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And so you talked a little bit about granny midwives
mm-hmm.
in the U.S., who they are. And you talked some about the Shepherdstown Act, which was something that Shepherdstown, is that what the act is called?
Yes.
I have to remember because I have so many words swimming around.
Exactly.
And that was essentially outlawing granny midwives.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very critical in this conversation. I always bring that up in any conversation that I have because I want to ensure that people understand that the mindset
mm-hmm.
behind that is still in how we function today.
Exactly.
So let's talk about that. Can you give the people a little bit of a rundown on what had happened with
yes.
midwives?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I give a historical background on the history of midwives. And so the first Black midwives specifically were enslaved Black women. And so they were delivering care for the enslaved women, but also for mistresses, pretty much delivering care for everyone. And also, even prior to enslavement, there were midwives in North America supporting indigenous birth, birth as something sacred, a ceremony. And so midwives have existed all over forever. But going back to the Black granny midwives specifically, and so as the obstetrics and gynecology field began to professionalize in the 19th, 20th centuries, we see a shift where it's no longer immodest, quote unquote, for men to be in the birthing room and then also delivering care. And so during this time period, while midwives are still delivering care, we have figures like J. Marion Sims, who is experimenting on enslaved Black women to lay the foundation of information about fistula and other ailments in gynecology. And so we see this shift of now birth and just reproductive health is now in the hands of a predominantly white male group of people. And so during this time period, we also see many public health campaigns around the US, but particularly in the South, where granny midwives were practicing prolifically, where we have campaigns of granny midwives being described as quote unquote dirty, quote unquote ignorant, and not having the ability to have a safe birth. And so safety is starting to be defined as in a hospital setting instead of being at home. And so we're seeing this shift of not only what does it mean to have a safe birth, the location, but also who is giving that care. And so once we have this professionalization of obstetrics and gynecology, we then, like you said, have the Shepherd-Towner Act, which is fostering the creation of a predominantly white nurse population. And so then we see that the nursing field is also rising with obstetrics and gynecology. And so today we can see this with the midwifery workforce, which I believe is about 85% people who identify as white women. And so now, even today, most of the midwives practicing are nurse midwives. And so the granny midwives who are practicing at home, delivering all this care, that's more like associated with a certified professional midwife. And so there's a lot of state restrictions. It really depends on where you live, which access you have to particular types of midwives.
Yes. So, in short,
yes,
a profession that was, you know, community based became the word that you used was professionalized and certification based. Because you have a lot of granny midwives. I don't like using, sometimes you'll see the term lay midwives, and I don't like that term. But the granny midwives had a legacy of their grandmothers might have been midwives, their mothers might have been, and they learned that way. That is how they learned. And so when this, I mean, because people give birth. In order for the world, in order for the world to perpetuate, birth is going to have to happen, right?
Exactly. So
in short, you know, that I feel like it was seen as a way to capitalize on, because the other thing is that, you know, granny midwives may or may not have been paid. You go to the hospital, you have to pay.
Exactly.
The practices may not have been couched in scientific and peer-reviewed, but they were highly successful.
Exactly.
They would absolutely go to a midwife because they knew that the midwife would know how to care for them, whether it was using herbs, whether it was, you know, allowing the, empowering the woman to go through her process and be okay with her body doing what it can do. And I think that those things are some significant differences in what happens with a granny midwife and what was happening with in the hospitals. And of course, unfortunately, you know, sometimes when laws are created, there's laws that are created to marginalize and discredit. There was a lot of discreditation of granny midwives at that time when the law came out. I want to say it was in the, it wasn't very long ago, honestly,
in the 1920s.
It wasn't that long ago, 100 years, you know?
Exactly.
And some people, and we haven't even discussed the fact, which is an obvious fact though, that there's an equity conversation around, a diversity conversation, because who was giving birth at home with the midwives? People who could afford it. Many of which were women of African descent, indigenous women, et cetera. And they would be giving birth with people that they knew, right?
Exactly.
There, I actually have an interview on the podcast of a woman who is a fifth generation midwife.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
So I think that's two episodes before this one that will come out. And she... her grandmother can still go to a town where she delivered the majority of the people on the block.
That's amazing.
And, and that was a common thing.
Exactly.
That was a common thing. Yeah. So I think that, and I see how the circle is coming back full, where a lot of people are wanting to go to birthing centers or go to deliver at home. Instead of going to hospitals. And I think that has to do with a lot with having body autonomy and feeling safe, not being terrorized by the biases and the racial inequities and those kinds of things. And so that is something that is interesting and important to think about and to have conversation about, and to ask a birthing person going into hospitals, do you have midwives? What kind of midwives do you have? What are the differences between the midwives you have? Are they able to, because there are still some restrictions on what a midwife can do and what a doctor can do. And there are some advocacy around that and getting midwives to be able to do some of the things that the doctors, the OBGYNs do. So you talk about the definition of birth safety forming. And we know that New Jersey, I'll let you talk about where New Jersey is. You did a couple of states, but we'll talk about New Jersey, which is our home base, and what that landscape is like. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm from New Jersey, so of course I had to do New Jersey as one of my state case studies for the research. But I would categorize New Jersey as kind of like a middle ground state in terms of most restrictive to most integrative and accepting of midwives. But even I would say it's also more integrative than most states as well. But yes, so in New Jersey, all types of midwives are able to practice. And by all, I mean certified nurse midwives, certified midwives, and certified professional midwives. But again, I think there's only about 8 to 10% of births in New Jersey are delivered by nurse midwives or assisted by nurse midwives. So there's definitely a long way to go to increase that number, but New Jersey has some really amazing initiatives to just diversify the midwifery workforce, increasing reimbursement rates, especially for Medicaid, which I think is really crucial in terms of the equity piece for who even has access to midwifery care. But yes, I would say New Jersey has a more favorable environment for midwives, but there's still a really long way to go too.
What are some of the differences between a certified nurse midwife, a certified?
Oh, sure.
There's the different ones. So
Yes.
I, yes.
I can define those. So, yes, a certified nurse midwife is an advanced nurse practitioner. So, they have a bachelor's of science in nursing. But in New Jersey, actually, the only midwifery education is a doctorate at Rutgers. But in general, a nurse midwife is an advanced practice nurse. They have prescriptive authority. So very much akin to a lot of the things that OBGYNs can do besides the surgery aspect. And then certified midwives have similar work scope of practice as the nurse midwives. They just don't have the nursing degree component. And then the certified professional midwives, that is the only credential where your focus is on outside of hospital births. So those are the three types of midwives that I focus on in the
Certified professional midwives can work at birthing centers, et cetera. Certified nurse with midwives can work at either. Can any of them go home, or is the professional midwife is the only one that can work at from home?
They primarily work like in the home and birth centers, but I'm pretty sure, correct me if I'm wrong, but the nurse midwives can also work in a home setting, but that's pretty much they're mainly in like the hospital birth center setting. So I would say mainly home births, that's done by the certified professional midwives.
Excellent. So what are some of the primary differences and similarities between obstetric and midwifery models as they relate to shaping birth safety? So we talked a little bit about the historical, and how things came to be historically. Are those continued trends in the birthing world, or is it has it changed?
In terms of safety, I would say this was probably one of the most interesting things I found from the qualitative interviews I did with the OBGYNs and midwives. And so I think even though like the certified professional midwives and the nurse midwives may be practicing in different environments, I think the midwife profession in general has similar value systems of birth as a holistic, natural process, really patient-centered, focusing and honoring the birthing person's body and experience. And then I would say the obstetric model can have some of those aspects, but it's mainly focused on, are we having this safety? And so the themes that emerged from the interviews I had with the different providers, and so this kind of summarizes their models of care and views of safety. And so the midwives, the kind of tenets they spoke about when defining birth safety were first, providing patient-centered and individualized care. Second was promoting empowerment and autonomy for the birthing person. Third was mitigating quote unquote obstetric violence. And so I defined that in the paper. And then fourth was respecting birth as a natural and special process. And then meanwhile, the OBGYNs that I spoke to, their perspectives differed a lot based off of, you know, what was their identity and also where were they practicing. And so the three themes that came up from that were that a safe birth is first working with communities over the lifespan, second, collaborating with other providers, and third, occurring in the hospital. So a lot of variation in terms of what does safety even mean? And then how can we even promote safety if there's so many definitions of what that means?
Mm-hmm. That's such a, I'm finding in this work that really hammering down the definition and ensuring that people understand the definition of anything is very interesting. And it is informed by your experiences. It is informed by your experiences. However, when it comes to making decisions, that's where a lot of the muddle comes in. Obstetric violence, that's a strong terminology. What does that mean?
Yeah, so midwives directly quoted saying obstetric violence throughout the interviews. And so in my paper, so the term emerged. Give me one moment because I don't want to misspeak.
No problem. Take your time. Because I've heard the terminology before. And when I heard it before, I was like, well, what does that mean exactly?
Yes, exactly. So I have it pulled up. And so the term first appeared actually in Venezuela in 2007. And so it was defined as, quote, the appropriation of women's bodies and reproductive processes by health professionals expressed as dehumanizing treatment and or abusive medicalization and pantheonization of natural processes resulting in loss of autonomy and the capacity to decide freely about their own bodies, end quote. And now the World Health Organization describes it as, quote, disrespectful, abusive, or neglectful treatment during childbirth, end quote. And so this is the terminology that a lot of midwives used when they were talking about it, especially from their own experiences. So a lot of the midwives I talked to either had adverse outcomes within OBGYN or were practicing as doulas before they became midwives and saw what their clients were facing. And so they used this term directly, but that is kind of like the history and different definitions of the term.
It sounds to me like there's a battle between science and natural processes. And when I say science, I mean a controlled experience and a natural experience. And as we all know, birth, well, maybe all of us don't know, but every birth, every pregnancy can be very different.
Exactly.
So it's difficult to use a scientific process even with one person, let alone a group of people. And so I hear how that can be, because there's, I always say that, you know, doctors go to school for many years, right?
Exactly.
So what they learn is very ingrained in their psyche as this is how it needs to be done. Not to mention the fact that, you know, they have huge, you know, insurance policies and
exactly
threat of being sued and, you know, all of these things that is hanging over their head. And so and this is obviously not an excuse for, you know, the rate of cesareans or being rude to and disrespectful to birthing bodies at all. However, I'm seeing how that when you're talking about equity and seeing things through individuals' lens and people doing their own work of understanding why they think what they think, that can become very messy.
Exactly. I think I think OBGYNs actually have one of the highest malpractice insurance premiums. So
Wow.
You can see that coming through.
So there's so many considerations when it comes to how this conversation informs policy and practices And, you know, organizations like the Black Maternal Health Caucus, you know, as you highlighted in your paper, help to address the crisis and fill in the policy gaps with organizations, not with organizations, with the government. Ooh, wrong thing. through making these policy recommendations. One of the things that you talked about and what I've heard, and we're going to talk some more in depth about Medicaid restrictions and low income birthing options, and doctors that desire to serve women, birthing bodies, and that connection to maternal health, and that connection to birth safety. Because I think the ability to be reimbursed properly and the ability to pay has a lot to do with birth safety. And because at the end of the day, if people are not able to take their time, are having to bring in more people to meet the fiscal demands, don't have enough capital to create spaces that are comfortable and clean, or to have staff that is professional, that can impact the safety and the well-being of everybody involved. So I don't know if that's a question or what, but what is your what is your take on that? What did you find in the conversation? And we're going to end with that part one with that question.
Yes.
We're going to move into what will be part two. But yeah.
Yes. I don't know if I'll be able to cover all of this before we end, but okay. I So I think something that's really important to bring up, and that I've been speaking to about in general, not just for my thesis research, but the maternal health work I do broadly, is just thinking about the historical connection of what does it mean for a Black body, bodies of color, and the relationship to, again, how knowledge is produced for obstetrics and gynecology. And so even today, a lot of low income birthing people, the hospitals that they're going to are teaching hospitals. And so I think that's just another really important point to bring up in terms of thinking about who's providing care, and like, what is the cost of that? But in terms of, I think the biggest topic that I discuss on this is Medicaid. And so Medicaid is funded jointly through federal dollars and also state dollars. So there's a lot of variation in terms of what a Medicaid reimbursement rate looks like. This isn't just for maternal health, but in general, everything that Medicaid dollars is going towards, because states have to manage their budgets. The federal government does not have to do the same work that a state is doing. And so that's where we're seeing a lot of variation in care. And so in terms of this three states that I looked at, which are New Jersey, Washington State, and North Carolina. So Washington State and New Jersey have a similar federal match rate. So they're getting less federal money for the amount of state money that they're putting in per like Medicaid dollar, because they're like wealthier states. So the federal government is going to match the same. But then North Carolina, there's more federal dollars towards per Medicaid dollar. And so that's just one important thing, I think, to discuss when we're thinking about, okay, how can we leverage Medicaid in terms of like increasing reimbursement rates and things like that, because it is a lot to juggle for the state governments. But I think that's one piece. But in terms of how this maps onto the care that birthing people are receiving, low-income birthing people, so Medicaid is the largest single payer for births in the U.S. I think it covers about 53% of births. And also when we think about demographics-wise, so it's low-income birthing people of color more likely to have pre-existing conditions, which can lead to more adverse outcomes in terms of coupled with other things that are happening during their birthing experience. And so Medicaid is already therefore paying for the adverse outcomes that are happening for an already extremely vulnerable population. And so that's one piece. The second piece, I think, is again, the reimbursement rate. So this is something I talk about a lot in the paper. And so Medicaid reimbursement rates are low and highly variable, especially for midwifery care. And so even though the Affordable Care Act has a requirement for Medicaid to provide coverage for things like birth centers, the reimbursement rate for midwives is still very variable, and it's, again, very low. So that's something to think about when we're talking about, okay, how do we diversify a particular profession, but also how do we nurture that profession and make sure that it's something sustainable for the people entering it? And so I think that goes for midwives, but also for the OBGYN. So I've spoke to a lot of OBGYNs who come from low-income backgrounds and are like, I have so many student loans to pay off. Sometimes you have to negotiate, okay, which clients am I going to serve to be able to even pay off my own loans, even though they want to be serving the communities where they come from. And so I think that's another really important piece to bring up, just in terms of, you know, where is the money flowing? And then what does that mean for the demographics of a profession? Again, the financial sustainability. And so I think because of the structure of Medicaid, how variable it is, that can really impact the care that a birthing person is receiving, especially low-income birthing people of color. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers the question, but that's just a little bit of commentary.
That all informs our understanding, you know, as a general population on how all of it works. And I would venture to say that this is probably why, excuse me, this is probably why, you know, universal health care is probably necessary, because I feel like sometimes we are just, we are, what is the word? We are going around in a circle with the increments, mm-hmm. as opposed to just going for the gusto. Mm-hmm. Because the moment we solve one problem, another one arises.
Exactly.
Right. And it's like, okay, well, if we have universal care, then mm-hmm. that's not even something that we have to think about.
Exactly.
You know, honestly, let's just be, you know.
Exactly.
Let's just be honest.
And that's what a lot of the providers said too, when I asked them, you know, what do you think would be effective policy to improve maternal health outcomes? And they were like, we need universal health care. Yeah. So
I mean, it's really, because it doesn't make any sense that no profession, and I'm very adamant that in the caregiving space, that people certainly should not have to be worried about money when you're trying to take care of people. and take care of, I mean, can you imagine you are at the doctor and your doctor is, you know, trying to give you the correct care, and and instead of thinking about, you know, how to give you the best care possible, they're thinking about, how am I going to make my very large student loan payment this month, so that I can do my work as impactfully as possible, and really look at this from I just feel like there's so many things that we can heal here when we really do look at it and see how we can make it universal, because this is, I mean, it really, yeah, having to think about Medicaid when you're, or having to think about how to pay for anything. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that all of us have that idea. Teachers, you know, we're talking about great generation of teachers.
Exactly.
Well, teachers don't make much money, and they're dealing with a lot of children in one day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess it would be one thing if the children all came to your class ready. But we know that that's not the case, you know?
Exactly.
And so it's unfortunate that this is something that we have to have a conversation. I'm going to continuously push for universal health care, because I think that as a country that is so wealthy, that shouldn't be a problem, right? Even if we all have to pay more taxes, it's just easier. in my opinion. And it levels the playing field when you're talking about equity.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to continue on because I did my due diligence here.
Yes.
So one of the things that you talked about was birth equity and advocacy. And I always say to doulas, you know, you are absolutely an advocate. Okay.
Yes.
Not just for your family, the families that you serve, but for the state, for the community that you're in, for all of those things. Mm-hmm. Because you have, all of us are advocates, let's just be clear, because mm-hmm. we all have something that we can bring to the table. We can all pick up the phone and talk to our Congress person, our House of Representative person. We should. They are yeah. very accessible. I have talked to many of their aides, not them specifically, but their aides.
Even the aides.
You know, who will absolutely bring the conversation to them and have gotten things done. We have to understand that we are the government, right? But anyway, don't let me get on my soapbox about that. But if we want to see changes on a policy level, we cannot just say that this is what should be done. We definitely have to use our voices differently.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you in your, and adding to that, let me just say that I think that granny midwives lost their stance in society because someone else spoke for them. Because they couldn't navigate the landscape of policies and politics, mm-hmm. right? And somebody else stood in that gap, and there wasn't anybody in the echelons to understand their way of seeing things, so that there could be a better, for lack of a better word, a better compromise or a better system created for birthing in the country. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want that to happen again. We mm-hmm. have all these brilliant minds. We have these brilliant systems that work. You know, the midwifery model of care is the most successful model of care when it comes to taking. So it's not like we don't have anything that doesn't work. Yes. We do.
Exactly.
So the question is, how do we then, I love that you tied in, you know, the advocacy part. So talk a little bit about what you found in the willingness for these professionals, midwives and OBGYNs, to be advocates.
Mm-hmm. This was also probably one of the most interesting parts of the research too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is mainly focused on, this section was on kind of who determines policy for maternal health. And so the midwives, most of the midwives, almost all of them said, you know, midwifery is quote unquote political, like their profession, by nature of just being a midwife, that means they're advocates. That means that they have to be pushing for legislative action and everything. And there's also a sense of, you know, who even gets to control midwifery practice. The midwives I talked to really spoke about, you know, everyone wants to control our midwifery, but we don't really get a say in who's doing that. And a lot of that came down to certain midwives mentioned, you know, they've talked to representatives, but one representative is receiving funding from XYZ organization and therefore cannot do midwifery policy right now. Like, that's not what they can do. And so I think capital is really important when we're thinking about who can make political decisions. And so that was kind of like the midwifery side of it. And then the OBGYNs, in terms of being politically active, they have an obligation. It really depends on the individual. And so a lot of OBGYNs I spoke to, you know, some are really active now. Either they like slowed down their practice and are now more active in their state government or national government doing work around birth equity. And some OBGYNs want to just practice. And so I think, you know, a lot of midwives mentioned this too. They were like, we just want to practice, but we don't have that like luxury, quote unquote, to do that. And so I think, you know, when we're talking about who determines policy, it's also like, okay, who has the time and ability to just be, you know, working with patients all day? Who has to split the time between working with patients, advocating to even work with patients, just to have their profession be respected. And so I think, you know, those were really interesting parts. But one kind of point of convergence between the midwife interviews and the OBGYN interviews was that a lot of them felt like when they were politically active, it was something really positive. And so they could see the changes being made, not just in terms of, you know, the perinatal workforce, but all other aspects that are impacting maternal health care. But I think in general, when we focus a lot on providers for as a lever to birth safety, like, obviously, yes, we need a diverse workforce, we need a greater workforce, there's a shortage of OBGYNs. So, you know, of course, we need more providers. But I think it's also looking beyond just maternal health providers and looking at holistically, how do different systems intersect? And so that means we don't just need more providers, we need better insurance coverage, we need higher reimbursement rates, we need better collaboration across providers. And so, you know, I think this is all working, and the onus shouldn't just be on clinical providers like midwives and OBGYNs, but it should also be, you know, on everyone as a whole, because everyone's implicated in the system.
The question that was raised for me, I agree with that, and I found it interesting that midwives have to advocate, whereas OBGYNs, it seemed like it was sort of a luxury whether or not they did or not. And I think that may have to do with perhaps the pharmaceutical companies that they can represent, perhaps standing in that gap. And perhaps also with midwives, I know that there is a midwifery organization, I forgot what it's called, a national one, and most likely there's definitely one, the ones that are regional and or state, and I wonder what their political involvement is. Mm-hmm. But what I've learned from doing my own work as a parent leader and a paid leave leader and all of those things, mm-hmm. is that it's good when organizations that you're connected to make it, for lack of a better word, easy for you to be able to use what you have learned to advocate politically, right? So mm-hmm. whether it's sharing your story, whether it's, you know, having times and days where you meet with your representatives and your congresspeople and your people, mm-hmm. Those kinds of things really make a difference in the ways in which you, because if enough people raise their voice about mm-hmm. a particular thing, your representative or congressperson can't say that's not on my agenda right now. It has exactly. It's going to have to become a part of it. Okay. So it's very interesting to me. That's interesting to me, but I think that part of the solution is finding ways to pull people in to these larger conversations, pulling community members into these larger conversations. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is an effort by a lot of organizations to do that, to inform the work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. It makes so much sense. It's something that I've talked about since I was in college. I would always say, well, why are these organizations doing all this work? Who are they talking to be able
exactly.
to, you know, because it seems like stuff is not working, then they have to go back and who are you talking to? You know, it's just common sense, right? Maybe it was a childish mindset to think that way, but sometimes we know children have the most brilliant ideas because they're not bogged down by
everything.
Student loans, for example. But you know, I found that part to be very interesting as well. Mm-hmm. And then I also found it interesting, and this is the final point that I'll make personally, and then of course you can make whatever points you want to make. Mm-hmm. When talking about their work, midwives talked a lot about, there was a discussion about the social determinants of health, mm-hmm. and how I found it interesting that OBGYNs really looked at those social determinants, I guess, more than midwives, but midwives really actually felt the process of understanding the social determinants of health because of the way that they engage with their mm-hmm. clients. So they spend more time with their clients, mostly. So you know, they spend, I think it was 90 minutes they spend on their first visit, whereas an OBGYN would spend 45 minutes, and then in the subsequent meetings, they would spend about 15, 20 minutes. And we know that from going to doctor. If you've been to the doctor, we know that initial meeting may be longer, but your subsequent meetings are not going to be.
Exactly. Will be shorter.
Right. Whereas a midwife, they really build a relationship with the entire family, right? So they know about you. They get to know about you. They meet you regularly, you know, all of those things. And that really builds a different conversation. But the conversation that the part of it that was very interesting to me is the conversation around the care, the self-care for the midwives themselves. Yeah, that was a very interesting idea for me around that. Can you speak a little bit about that? If you, I know that was a lot of words, but what were your views on that? Like the emotional
emotional weight of the work,
Right, of the work, because it seems like the midwives take on more of the emotional weight. Even though the OBGYNs are aware that there are social determinants.
Mm-hmm. I think I also read an article about this recently in terms of the doula profession, but the article was like, there's a quote unquote caring dilemma. So, you know, you want to be there and support your client in all these ways, but you also have to think about, you know, like, what are my needs? What are my, you know, boundaries for my own emotional capacity. And so a lot of midwives I talked to brought that up just because it can be heavy work, especially when you're entering a space. And this is why I use a theoretical framework of authoritative knowledge. So, you know, we have midwives, even like certified nurse midwives, who are practicing in the hospital setting, but, you know, the hospital values obstetric and gynecological systems of knowledge more than they value even the nurse midwives' knowledge system, even though it's quite similar in some ways. You know, they have prescriptive authority, they're doing all of this other amazing work. So I think, you know, a lot of professions, the pandemic has magnified this, are experiencing burnout, but I think it's especially important in caring professions to think about, you know, what is a person's emotional capacity to do work? Because especially thinking long-term for sustainability, work for sustainability, you have to be able to make sure that you're not just increasing the amount of people in a profession, but you're making sure that, you know, they feel cared for, supported, so that they can then provide support to other people. And so I think that was something really important to bring up. And yeah, I think it was interesting, you know, the OBGYNs and the midwives are bringing up social determinants of health, but the OBGYNs are taking it from a lens of like clinically. So, okay, how can I address this in my purview here? While the midwives are like, okay, how can we get you connected to community resources and things like that? And so I think that also can shape, you know, what is in the purview of a particular profession, whether that's like in their credentials, but also, you know, what's outside of that? What are they doing beyond, you know, when they're in the hospital or birthing center to support their clients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that topic around caregivers and who's caring for the caregivers and how, because I remember reading it. It was a book about from the voice of a midwife, and she said, I'm trying to remember the title of the book. Can't remember right now, but she was saying that, and she was a part of the midwives that were being trained by hospitals to have both that medical knowledge and their own source, to be an exchange of knowledge, basically. And she was talking about how, you know, she did a lot of work, but it was heartfelt work. And she would be tired a lot of times and not paid well a lot of times. But that it was rewarding for her, and that she did get by some way, somehow. And there's a lot that goes into that. But I do feel like, you know, when it comes to caregivers, oftentimes there is a thought that, you know, there's this unlimited capacity for patience and graciousness and
exactly.
They're people. They're just people.
They're people too. Exactly.
They're people who have the passion for this, but they still need the time to rest. And mm-hmm. even, you know, a lot of people had knowledge as midwives and doulas. Now we see the rise of a lot of doulas and people. I think that there's this idea that there's too many and there will be a flood. And I'm like, there could never be too many.
Exactly. Because
you will always need this kind of care. And so mm-hmm. anybody who has the knowledge who will be able to stand in the gap significantly assists others. And so that's something to consider. It's like, okay, how do you have people to support? I think of it as sort of like doctors don't do all of the details.
Mm-hmm.
They have somebody to schedule appointments. They have somebody to debrief them. They have somebody to, you know, call their coat when they're about to go into surgery. Like, they don't have to, because that's giving them that's preserving their energy.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how do you get people to preserve their energy, midwives, doulas, to preserve their energy so that they have a better capacity to deepen what they do?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's an extremely important task for considering burnout in a career,
mm-hmm.
individual burnout, and keeping the sacredness of the career as well.
Mm-hmm.
Profession, I should say. So on that note, you know, I always like to always drive things home around self-care.
Mm-hmm.
But is there anything else that is central to your research that you want to highlight or discuss? I think this is a really robust conversation around policy and nurse midwives and the different kinds of midwives and OBGYNs.
Exactly.
And, what to consider. Is there anything else that you feel like must be included or said? Conversation that you want people to understand or know?
Sure. I would say, you know, we've talked a lot about the safety side, but, you know, I think we also need to talk about, like, what is a good birth? And so what does that mean? And so this really, like, solidified for me, like, this is what it means to have a safe birth. And so there's a book by Dr. Ann Lyerly called A Good Birth. And she says, quote, "It's not about trading off safety for some abstract notion of a good or more meaningful birth." And so I think when we're talking about safety, and again, how definitions of things can get muddled, but I think safety, ultimately, there's no mutually exclusive. It's not you're having a safe birth or you're having a good birth. You know, we have good and safe births when we're valuing birthing people. And so I think when we're talking about delivering care, when we're talking about improving outcomes, addressing racial disparities in maternal health, in the maternal health crisis in the US, you know, we have to realize that we need to value all birthing people. We can't have these conversations without birthing people at the table. Mm-hmm. So that's what I would like to conclude with.
Yes, I absolutely totally agree. And it's, you know, the midwifery, that was another thing that struck me in your paper about the midwifery model of care and what was said about it. You know, in the model of care, it's human-centered. So,
yes.
You know, you meet people where they are.
Exactly.
It humanizes people, and it is grounded in the idea or understanding that the birthing person is not just their state of pregnancy. They're
exactly.
A whole person, right? So they're a whole person with dreams, ideals, you know, all of that. And so we have to, in order for it to be a good birth, we have to know how to meet that person, how to listen to that person where they are, how to, you know, respect that birth as is, but also respect the person before, during, and after as well. Maternal mortality. Yeah. So with that said, as I said, this was a very robust conversation. I'm sure that, you know, individuals have gotten so much out of it, and they will be able to hopefully utilize the information in informing their advocacy, informing their birthing options, informing just information on what is going on in the state of New Jersey. And if you're not in New Jersey, looking at what is happening in your communities around the world. So how do you connect with people? What are you doing now? And what would you, how do you want people to stay connected with you?
Yeah, so you can find me on LinkedIn. I also can share my email address too, but I'd love to get connected on people who are doing birth work, especially around equity. So that's where you can find me. And I also just wanted to say thank you so much for giving me the time and space, and just creating this space for me to speak with you, Cecile.
So, it is absolutely my pleasure. I'm so thankful that you took the time to do this. And when I heard about it, I was like, yeah, she has to be on the podcast. So I'm glad that you accepted and that you were interested in doing it. And you're here. I'm very, yes. Very thankful for that. Very thankful that you are here and able to share this important work. And I look forward to hearing more about your work and how you expand on this and how you put this into action in the communities that you work in. So thank you so much. And this was the Mommy Matters podcast. Look forward to seeing you the next time around. Peace and love.
Did you like that? I know it was as informative for you as it was for me. Look, this is a process for all of us. And to keep this process going, I would love to invite you to donate to our podcast. We want to continue to give you high-level content, beautiful content that enlightens and inspires and broadens your vision to elevate you and evolve. So please feel free to go to the podcast page at anchor.fm/mommymatters. We would love to hear your questions and comments as well, so that we can discuss them in future podcasts. And you can email that to momevolve@gmail.com. You can also visit the website and send your comments there, www.mommyevolve.com. And I look forward to seeing you in the next episode. Peace and love.